Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us in our final session from this Life Group series over the problem on race. Followers of Jesus have had to wrestle with a lot of challenging questions over the past few months about their complicity in racism and some of the popular solutions being put forward out there. As we wrap up our discussion today, we're not going to be spending as much time on the race issue particularly as much as we are on the topic that surrounds it. We'll be talking about Christian power and influence and what role that should and shouldn't play when we consider things like social justice today. This session is also going to take a little longer than usual. Again, there are a lot of challenging passages in the Bible to consider on this topic, so I hope that you'll take a few notes again and pause for breaks to absorb it all. And let me give you a fair warning before I even start. The views I express on this topic may not be views you've heard before. You need to wrestle with these issues yourself, and there's a good chance you might come to some different conclusions than me, and that's okay. We encourage you to come to your own conclusions in good conscience. My hope is that what you hear today will be a great starting point for further discussion. My first year in college was coming to a close. Like so many other college students, I was trying to figure out how I was going to get through it all without taking on a huge burden of debt. It just so happened that a job opened up in the dorm I was living in. Our floor supervisor was moving out and moving on. An opportunity for free room and board was in sight. But it took me a while to come around to it. Less than a year before that, I had given my life to Jesus. And stepping onto campus and away from my hometown was an opportunity to reinvent myself, to really take this Jesus thing seriously without the baggage and expectations that came from old relationships. And it was a thrilling first year. I made exciting connections with more people than I can remember. And I got the opportunity to introduce other people to Jesus too. And it wasn't always received well. There was pushback. There was awkwardness. But that made it exciting too. And I think more people were open to my message because I didn't seem to be coming with an agenda. I did my best to love people where they were at. I didn't come to the table with expectations. Would taking on this supervisor role change that? People look at you differently when you're in a position of authority. It's not as easy to be personal with your boss, your teacher, or your parole officer. And to me, there was nothing more personal than the message of Jesus. I ended up taking the job, and God used that job. But I think that I lost something too. That's because Christianity has always had an uneasy relationship with power. But so many conversations about Christianity in the public square are about power, particularly the political kind today. On the one hand, we see more talk about Christian nationalism, which is a merging of American democracy and the Christian faith. Christian nationalists seek to pass laws that are consistent with their beliefs about Christianity and its role in political and social life, embracing a more conservative set of political values. On the other hand, there is a strong push among Christians to embrace a bigger form of government in the name of social justice, especially for those they perceive to be marginalized. They want to see a more equitable distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges in society, and they see the scriptures as mandating modern governments to provide systems like this. It's a part of a Christian's witness, they say, not simply to model justice in itself, but to call every system to the standard the Bible sets forth. There's something appealing about both ideas. After all, how can those of us who are living in a democratic society simply put aside our Christian values when we go to the voting booth, as if our faith didn't inform our worldviews? And wouldn't we want people everywhere to be treated fairly and to equally enjoy the privileges that God's people were responsible for nurturing and preserving in the Bible? But whatever perspective you find yourself more in tune with, if any of them, where do Christians draw the line in holding an outside world accountable to the values they hold to by faith? If we could do it, would our moral policing even be effective? Would it honor God? I'm going to be upfront with you. There are no easy answers to the question about a modern Christian's relationship with power. Part of that is simply because there is no instruction manual for Christians living under a government where they have a say. What happens when Christians share power with people who hold different values than they do? Is that something the early church could have ever envisioned? It was certainly something that they never faced. There may be no clear directions for us on how Christians should participate in a democratic republic, but God does give us some clear principles that we can embrace. If you're still trying to figure out the Jesus thing, what we're going to talk about may not resonate with you as much. You can sit back and tag along with us. I hope that you'll walk away a little bit encouraged by what we're going to learn about this complex subject, maybe even a little bit challenged. On the other hand, if you're a follower of Jesus, what we're going to talk about is important. Because in this cultural moment we find ourselves in, Christians need to be able to clearly articulate their relationship with power and their positive desire for the world. If you are a parent who's building relationships with non-Christian parents in your neighborhood, a family member who is struggling to connect with an uncle or grandparent who's resistant to the faith, or an employee at your company where your coworkers have had negative experiences with religious people, you have the potential to be a miracle for one of those people. You can unlock some of the misconceptions about God and the world and be an invitation for people to find rest and peace in Jesus. And as we'll learn, that's not just something that's good for them. It'll be good for your relationship with God too, as you honor him in the way that you portray him in a world that is disengaged. How can believers be faithful witnesses to Jesus when their relationship with power impacts those who don't believe? That's the question I want to explore with you today. The first Christians may not have found themselves ruling over other groups of people like their ancestors would, but they would also be confronted with the question of power. In Mark chapter 10, a couple of Jesus' disciples approached him, asking him to rule at prominent places at his side. Jesus tells them that such a place is not for him to give. But the other 10 disciples were in earshot. Mark writes that they became indignant. Perhaps Jesus could hear them grumbling one to the other. Jesus responded, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all." That bit about the rulers of the Gentiles would have resonated with the disciples. They had experienced the oppressive rule of Roman leaders firsthand, and they fully expected their rule to be overturned. But they didn't expect to see the concept of leadership flipped on its head. One commentator writes, "At no place do the ethics of the kingdom of God clash more vigorously with the ethics of the world than in the matters of power and service." Perhaps a rebuttal started to form in one of the disciples' mouths, and Jesus didn't give him time to respond. In one sentence, he settles any questions over whether he's advocating for the abolition of power, and he silences his critics. "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." The Son of Man isn't a subdued reference to Jesus' humanity as many take it. It was a deeply religious reference to a mysterious figure in the prophetic writings of Daniel, hundreds of years before Jesus. This figure shares divine authority and power with God himself. Simply by using that title for himself, Jesus affirmed without question that God has sent him to rule his kingdom. But even he was not sent to be served. Rather, the King of Kings was commissioned to be a servant, to the point of giving his very life. And if this kind of service wasn't too low for a king this high, it certainly wouldn't be too low for his followers also. In his commentary, James Edwards draws his readers to Jesus' use of the word give. The reason why a servant is the most preeminent position in the kingdom of God is that the sole function of a servant is to give, and giving is the essence of God. The goal of Christian leadership is not to take, it's to give. Putting that into practice as an individual is one thing. But are there ways Christians might corporately use their power to live out this principle of Christian leadership in the public square? One approach is to call on our government to bring about some change. And many are calling for social justice. Teachers like Tim Keller have pointed to gleaning laws that allowed the immigrant, the fatherless, and the widow to harvest the edges of landowners' fields. Keller argues that landowners were not to harvest out the edges of their field, maximizing profits for themselves and then later out of their great wealth, helping the poor only through philanthropy. Rather, landowners had to leave some of the produce in the field so that their hired workers and the poor could come glean and get food through their own labor. He concludes that to be radically generous is not only a matter of mercy, but of justice. The modern society has certainly taken some cues from Old Testament practices like these. Can you imagine a world without libraries or public schools? Where would people be at without some of the safety nets in place to protect the poor? Societies that have freely chosen to make economic sacrifices for those who have less elevate everyone. The followers of Jesus also know that the Old Testament needs to be read with care. It only presents a part of a developing story where God is slowly revealing himself over the course of thousands of years. God's whole story includes shifts and surprises, like the introduction of a new covenant through Jesus that calls readers to view what happened earlier through what God would accomplish later. A fact that's rarely addressed is that Israel lived under a theocracy, a system of government that placed a unified people with shared religious values under the direct or indirect rule of God. Some of you might be thinking, surely that fact shouldn't keep us from bringing some of those ancient principles to bear on modern governments. And I agree. And yet, could modern Christians be missing something by expecting those they live with to adopt the same social practices that they embrace? Some might argue that we can't force people to adopt all our religious values, but we can bring about a better society by championing some of its civil practices, like calls for justice. Micah 6:8 is one of the most popular verses on biblical justice today. God is using the prophet to call his people to account. Listen to what he says. What does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. The Lord's call to act justly shares much in common with the calls for justice today. In Micah 3:11, we're told about judges who were bribed, priests who were paid under the table, and prophets who did illicit things for money. It was an unfair and unjust use of power. But if this call to return to justice was enough, Micah wouldn't have had to share what followed. There were already laws protecting and providing for the poor. God's people were well acquainted with laws that prohibited bribes and showing favoritism and judgments. When God tells them that he requires them to act justly, he's telling them to do better. But we can't do better without embracing something else. Notice what he says next. Love mercy and walk humbly with your God. The NIV reads love mercy here, but most versions don't translate it as mercy. That's because the Hebrew word hesed is rarely used that way. Instead, it's more commonly rendered loyalty or faithfulness. Why would God want his people to love loyalty or faithfulness? Well, Micah isn't talking about loving faithfulness as an abstract principle or idea. He's talking about loving faithfulness or loyalty to God. In the previous verse, he asks, will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams? 10,000 rivers of olive oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul. Micah isn't suggesting that these sacrifices have no value, but he was saying that those who practiced injustice should not continue to do evil and rely on their offerings to put them in good standing with God. If they don't love faithfulness to God, they'll never practice justice, even if it's codified into law. Powerful people will just find ways around it. The power of biblical ethics is personal and genuine devotion to God. As convenient as it might be to cut out civic lessons from the Old Testament, they are deeply connected to a wholehearted faithfulness to God. The prophets would have never envisioned them operating independently of each other. Okay, so maybe we can't expect a perfect government to result by enforcing some of the Old Testament's civic values on society that is in part or mostly secular. But if some societal order could be attained for the common good, wouldn't it be best to legislate these principles anyway? In a provocative discussion on the Christian's relationship to government, the Apostle Paul painted a positive view of the government that persecuted him. But the good that it had to offer wasn't to enforce a Christian agenda. In Romans 13, he writes, "Let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, whoever rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from fear of the one in authority? Then do what is right, and you will be commended. For the one in authority is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for rulers do not bear the sword for no reason. They are God's servants, agents of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. Therefore, it is necessary to submit to the authorities, not only because of possible punishment, but also as a matter of conscience." This passage became rather infamous in 2018 when former Attorney General Jeff Sessions quoted it as support for the government's authority to prosecute people who violated the law. It created quite a stir then, with some Christians rising up to support Attorney General and some to refute him. And it would have been wildly controversial in Paul's day as well. The Christians to whom he wrote were under the constant threat of persecution, and the government was not their friend. Although Paul at times received protection from the government because of his Roman citizenship, he often found himself at odds with that same government as well. And yet he not only tells his readers to be subject to those authorities, he says they have been established by God and even calls them servants of God. Paul must have known his Old Testament. A nation did not have to be good for God to use it. Both the Assyrians and Babylonians were called servants of God for bringing Israel into exile, but they were also punished for their motives and methods in doing so. That's important to keep in mind, because the same government that Paul is encouraging Christians to submit to was the government that would end up unjustly taking his life. And chances are that same government had already taken some of the lives of his friends. But Paul doesn't put any qualifier on his statement here. The government wasn't a servant of God only as long as it was a just government, and Rome wasn't. It was a servant of God regardless. Rome might end up serving God's purposes, much like Assyria and Babylon before it, by persecuting Christians. Certainly by killing Jesus, it unwittingly contributed to his appointment over everything. Remember the centurion at Jesus' death who declared that Jesus must certainly be the Son of God after watching the way he died. But Paul had something more specific in mind. They are God's servants to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. Paul doesn't tell us what kind of wrongdoing he had in mind, but it was probably civil wrongdoing, because he certainly wouldn't have expected the Roman government to embrace and sustain a Christian ethic. The Roman government brought order and protected people from violence and abuse. But Paul isn't making a general statement about the purpose of government for everyone. Without a doubt, everyone benefits when people who do wrong to others are held accountable. But Paul primarily had the Christian in view. This is the key line. The one in authority is God's servant for your good. He's talking about his audience. God was using Rome for the Roman Christians. But what is Paul referring to when he mentions the Christian's good? It could mean a lot of things, including the personal prosperity of the Christian or blessings for all Christian people. But blessings and prosperity don't really fit the context. Scholars who have compared it to wrongdoing in the same verse have concluded that the best answer might be the most surprising one. It's not about the good they receive. It's about the good that they do. Human authorities are God's servants for enabling Christians to do good for other people. The protection that government offers allows them to display the love of God through acts of generous service without the constant threat of persecution from others. God's role for human government is not to do good for us, it's to enable us to do the good ourselves. This is a much different vision for power than what we're used to. And I can see it raising all sorts of charges from the early Christians of Paul's day. After hearing one of the Christians read this aloud in their small house church, perhaps Urbanus said, "What about our rights? The tax collectors are always taking more from the Christians because they know we won't retaliate. And everyone hates us, so we're soft targets. If those in authority are supposed to be servants of God, why aren't they helping us when we're not helping the poor?" A few nod their heads knowingly. Maybe Junia, who was well respected by the apostles, was more concerned about some of the injustices she saw among her non-Christian friends, the things that they were facing. What about the mistreatment of some of the local slaves? Certainly, Paul couldn't have overlooked the injustices committed against them. How could he call the Roman authorities servants of God when they have so clearly neglected the least of these? Perhaps her husband, Andronicus, put her arm around her and nodded too. Think about those concerns. Let them sit for a second. Those are some of the same questions we find ourselves asking today. Why didn't God give these early Christians a more just vision for the government? A couple of days ago, Phil Vischer of VeggieTales fame put out a video entitled, "How Should We Vote? One Christian's Guide to Approaching the Voting Booth." After a survey covering how American Christians got themselves in the current conundrum they're in, he cites a well-respected scholar on the book of Proverbs who characterizes biblical justice in this way. "The righteous are willing to disadvantage themselves and to advantage the community. The wicked are willing to disadvantage the community to advantage themselves." Vischer concludes, "We vote to advantage our communities, even if it disadvantages ourselves. We vote for the benefit of the least of these whenever they are in the world. We speak up for those who cannot speak up for themselves. We vote for the good of our neighbors and the flourishing of our world." Vischer goes on to list a series of people who might be considered the least of these today: the unborn, immigrants and refugees, those without health care, those affected by climate change, and those affected by racial injustice. Some people might respond by saying that the church should focus on the gospel and not the issues. Sharing the message of Jesus is central to the Christian mission. In Luke chapter 4, verse 43, he said, "I must proclaim the good news of the kingdom of God because that is why I was sent." Proclamation comes before transformation. And the reality of judgment, as unpleasant as it is for so many of us to talk about, makes sharing the message the most urgent thing. In Matthew chapter 24, verses 42 through 44, Jesus said, "Keep watch, because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. If the owner of the house had known at what time of the night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and would not have let his house be broken into. So you also must be ready, because the Son of Man will come in an hour when you do not expect him. The world faces a lot of problems, but judgment is pressing. When the kitchen is on fire, we don't spend our time fixing a leaky roof. And yet, shouldn't our good news be accompanied by real good in the world that we live in? What is more Christ-like than disadvantaging ourselves for the advantage of our communities, especially the least of these? When the Apostle Paul was called to bring the gospel to the Gentiles, he tells us that the leadership of the church at the time embraced his call with one caveat. All they asked was that we should continue to remember the poor, the very thing that I had been eager to do all along. Helping those in need and even doing good under those in power characterized the early church. The Apostle Peter encouraged good in all kinds of relationships with the outside world, to live among them in such a way that they may see their good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits. And yet, the American political system is complex. Simplifying political parties to a set of values does an injustice to people who represent both sides. I get it. Wouldn't it be nice if voting were easy, especially in these tumultuous times? But rarely would representatives of one party say they are against any of those people marginalized in the list presented above. More often than not, parties are wrestling for control over a difference in political strategies, not values. Vischer himself has questioned whether laws concerning abortion will really help the unborn. Based upon the other groups that he's listed above, that's going to make him a Christian that votes one way. But other Christians voting the other way might disagree with him there and propose strategies on things like immigration that they feel are better for immigrants while protecting residents whom open borders might harm. I'm not here to weigh in on those difficult matters. I'm just saying that we can't pretend that voting as Christians today is as simple as selecting the party that does the best at helping people in need, whether that's the immigrant or the unborn. And that brings us perhaps to the most important point about voting, one that's rarely discussed, but one that would have made it such a strange thing in the early church. It's one thing to disadvantage ourselves for the advantage of the community. That's something that we should be all about. But it's another thing telling someone else they should be disadvantaged for the good of the community. Just because a Christian is willing to pay more taxes to provide for the homeless doesn't mean his secular neighbor is. Just because a Christian is willing to refuse the use of certain kinds of birth control doesn't mean that other people are. The Christian can't pretend that voting one way or the other is simply a use of our power to help the disadvantaged. It's forcing other people to do it with us. And that puts us in a difficult place. That's because whether you are a Christian who wants higher taxes from the rich for social programs, or whether you are a Christian who wants stricter drug laws to protect a generation whose lives are threatened by them, you are forcing people to do something or preventing them from doing something that they disagree with. And whether it's intended or not, it sends a different message about the love of God than we want. That it costs. That it comes with prerequisites. That people need to get right before they can find God. And it puts a stumbling block in front of the world to receiving the gospel, which is the very most important thing. In a passage on church discipline, the Apostle Paul spoke parenthetically on a matter that proves very important for this conversation today. Paul argued that Christians need to separate themselves from other Christians who are causing spiritual harm to the church and harm to themselves for the ultimate healing and restoration of both. And then Paul clarifies, "I wrote to you in my letter not to associate with sexually immoral people, not at all meaning the people of this world who are immoral, or the greedy, or the swindlers, or the idolaters, in that case, you would have to leave the world. And Paul's language is, it's a bit blunt. But he is saying that we should have positive, meaningful relationships with people in the world, no matter what their baggage is. And he implies that the reason for this is to extend an open invitation for them to freely be transformed. There is no expectation and no cost. He concludes, "What business is it of mine to judge those outside the church? That's God's job, not mine." It's possible that God didn't give the early church a more just vision for their government for several reasons. First, the gospel was so pressing that it needed to take precedence. Second, God used the government to allow them to embody and offer the kind of just life that his future kingdom would be about. And third, wielding power to enforce values on an unwilling population is never a good witness to the gospel. And even though we live in a radically different context today, those are still principles we can embrace. How can believers be faithful witnesses to Jesus when their relationship with power impacts those who don't believe? That's the question that I asked at the beginning of our time together. Given what we've learned about Christian leadership, God's purpose for government, and God's desires for the gospel, we'll be able to best advance God's kingdom if we deny power when we can, give generously whenever we're able, and create opportunities for the gospel always. Faithful witnesses to Jesus deny power when they can, give generously whenever they're able, and create opportunities for the gospel always. Let's consider each of those a little further, because you're bound to have some questions. We just spent plenty of time talking about voting. If Christians deny power when we can, should they not vote or refuse to run for public office? But what about something as small as taking a promotion at their place at work? I'm not saying that we should deny those opportunities at all. Some might even take the stance that Christians who are members of a democratic republic have a responsibility toward their government to vote in much the same way that ancient Christians had the responsibility to pay their taxes. But what could an uneasiness about forcing people to line up with our values do to shape all of those opportunities? What if we exercised more care to only vote for the issues that only government could solve? That certainly doesn't make voting less complex. It doesn't make it any more simple. And it doesn't necessarily favor one side of the current divide either. One Christian might say that legislating abortion is simply too important, and that's something only government intervention can address, even if they prefer no government intervention at all. Another Christian might say the same thing about climate change or addressing issues of race. And Christians in good conscience will disagree. But what if we were more openly uneasy with power and only exercised it when it was absolutely essential? Might it change the perception of Christians in the public square as a voting bloc that's trying to instate some form of Christendom? Maybe that won't change people's perception on a national level, but it could change our relationships with our neighbors, the people we work with, and our friends. What about running for office or taking on some positions of power in the workplace? When I was in college, I was a student senator for several years. I never ran. I hated the idea of putting myself out there. I just ended up filling a vacant seat for my major, which was undecided. No one else wanted to represent the undecideds. But my third year of college, a vacancy for the Speaker of the Senate opened up. If I was going to be the speaker, I had to make my case before the student body senate. I actually ran on a Bible verse that I memorized, one we covered. "For the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." I ended up getting the job. but I didn't end up filling expectations. The Senate had a negative image among the students for not doing anything that helped the students. So armed with good intentions, I lobbied to forego a tradition, using Senate money to purchase the senator's student government branded polo shirts. That wasn't popular among the senators. I also became notorious for checking in with people to make sure they were filling their office hours, an expectation of senators that really didn't serve any purpose because no student ended up meeting with the senator anyways. We could have changed that rule, but we didn't, and I ended up enforcing a pointless rule. In an effort to clean up the image of the Senate, I wasn't really serving the senators or the student body. I was more concerned with what I thought they should be doing. The Bible never abolishes leadership, it reshapes it. What would my tenure in office have looked like if I would have spent more energy helping them to think about the good that they could do and serving them on a personal and individual basis? Granted, we weren't determining rules that had a significant impact on the student body. People who are running for public office are shaping how we're taxed, what rights we have, and how we're going to provide for people in need. But could those Christians running for office focus on the major things and compromise with people more on everything else? Could they demonstrate the life of Jesus in the way they treated all people and in their uneasiness to demand too much? When we look for opportunities to deny power or use our authority to serve and give, we might create interesting opportunities to share a gospel that has been trampled on today. Not everyone will respond to the invitation of the gospel. Jesus made that very clear. But thinking about power and practicing authority in a Christian way might help the world to recover the fact that the gospel is an invitation and not an expectation. But there's more we can do to help people see the gospel as it was meant to be. God doesn't just call Christians to be generous individually. He calls us to have a positive corporate witness that invites people everywhere to experience the justice and healing of the world to come. This is something that Christians used to be quite good at, as so many of the hospitals today bear Christian names for a reason. When it became publicly acceptable to be Christian, many institutions rose up to care for the orphans, the poor, and to support those in need. This is the kind of good that Paul believed God commissioned the government to enable Christians to do. It was the kind of good he himself was eager to do alongside his mission to the Gentiles. Phil Vischer, who we mentioned earlier of VeggieTales fame, shared a story about this kind of good practice by Christians in the second part of a viral video about the problem of race in America. He said, "My mother is a retired college professor. Our lives fell apart when I was 9 and my parents split up. For several years, we ended up living below the poverty line. But we had a house, and she was able to use that equity to move us to a suburb of Chicago with great schools and ample opportunity. Our house funded our second chance. Realizing how much home ownership had helped us, she recently wrote a check from a retirement fund that gave an underprivileged family in one of Chicago's poorest neighborhoods the down payment towards their first house. Our church was so inspired by that they're setting up a program, partnering with an inner city ministry to do the same thing on a large scale. Not saviors, allies. A home, an education, an opportunity changes the course of a family. Change the course of enough families, and you can change the course of a community." Part of the reason I love that idea is it hits an area of need for impoverished black families that resulted from terrible social practices in the past, like redlining, that kept black families from owning homes and established the equity needed to lift them out of poverty. And it's not simply the church telling someone else to do the good for them. It's the church doing the good itself. One of my former pastors often shared a provocative question with the church. What if we were so involved in blessing the community that the community would pitch in to keep us alive if we were ever on the brink of shutting down? And when the Old and New Testament prophets cast a vision for the future, they never predicted a reality where the church was embraced by the outside world. So a part of me resisted that. But when the church makes sacrifices for the good of the world, it definitely turns an ear. And that's the kind of social justice everyone can get on board with. The world doesn't react kindly when we ask it to make our sacrifices for us. But when we serve the world generously with no expectation of return, we earn a chance for the gospel to be heard. And that's the hope of the world. Faithful witnesses to Jesus deny power when they can. They give generously when they're able. And lastly, they create opportunities for the gospel always. The world needs to know that God loves them, that Christ died for them, and that they can experience real life and power by putting their trust in him. Our actions go a long, long way towards leading people there. Peter encouraged wives of unbelieving husbands to behave in such a way that they may be won over without words when they see the purity and reverence of their lives. A life of good deeds, honor, and respect is sometimes all it takes to make the message of Jesus come alive. But in contrast to those who say, preach the gospel, and if necessary, use words, the Apostle Paul left no question about the importance of a verbal invitation. In Romans chapter 10, verse 13, Paul quotes Joel chapter 2, verse 32. Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. And then he asks a series of rhetorical questions that drives his point home. How then can they call on the one they have not believed in? And how can they believe in the one they have not heard? And how can they hear without someone preaching to them? And how can anyone preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. What kind of beautiful footprints might we leave in the world when at the right time and in the right place, with perhaps an opportunity earned, we can tell someone about the love of Christ? Could you be the miracle a coworker, a relative, or even a spouse needs by your conduct and message? What would it be like to just see one person transformed because of your courage to love and share? Friends, we live in complicated times, and it's frustrating when the good we want to do can carry so much baggage. But God has called us to be thoughtful with our love, innocent with our goodness, and purposeful about our convictions. We might live in a different world than the first Christians, but their principles can still guide us to be faithful witnesses to a better world to come.